Okay, please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, George from the Early Bird Breakfast Club Home Group.
I'm George, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, George.
I don't think I've ever spoken for a solid 40, I've definitely spoken for a solid 45 minutes of my life, just usually about not anything in any kind of direction, so I'm going to try and keep this orderly for once. That's an ice maker? I thought that was the feedback.
So just stay here?
George, I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, George.
Hey, George.
Starting off at the beginning, I was born in 99 to two parents that met in Alcoholics Anonymous and are still in the program to this day. I am very grateful that I grew up seeing an example of how sobriety could work. I am just astonished that seeing two parents that are having learned about alcoholism my entire life, that I continue to take the first drink, of course, before I was legally allowed to, age of 17. I knew that I was an alcoholic, or I know now that I was an alcoholic before I ever took the first drink. My entire life, I was completely miserable, and I didn't know why. I was always a little different than the other kids. I'd never really seemed to get along. I've heard various theories, various terms flown around by doctors or whatever, but I truthfully only believe that that's just that I'm an alcoholic. The people in this room, the people that I've met within the rooms, are the only people that I've ever really been able to relate to. And that's a great benefit of having gotten sober, is that it led me to all of these other people that are different like myself. I was restless, irritable, and discontent from a very young age before I ever discovered alcohol. And when I discovered alcohol, I knew that I never wanted to do anything else. The first drink. I can't say I had a particularly bad childhood. School was stressful. I didn't get along with kids. People made fun of me. Cry me a river. But I sought thrills to pull me out of this discontent that I thought made me different from other people, and truthfully it did, it just didn't make me different from the people in this room. I was discontent my entire life, and I looked for ways of entertaining that, to pull myself out of that thrill-seeking behavior. And the first instance I'll hone in on was I was 15 years old. I was a freshman in high school, 3 months into high school, and I got kicked out for breaking and entering into my high school. On January 1st, New Year's Day, 10 p.m. Didn't take anything. I just had been playing a lot of Assassin's Creed, and I really wanted to, you know, climb on top of a building. And for me, it was just happy fun time. Like, I just like to be able to scale the side of it, you know, wear a ski mask, go through the attic, dig around in the attic, go through the rest of the school, draw dicks on whiteboards, go down in the steam class. You know, it was just playtime for me. Like, I've heard about people doing this stuff, but it didn't seem malicious to me. I was just having fun. The cops didn't think so. As with a number of instances throughout my life, looking back in hindsight, wearing a Guy Fawkes mask in a high school makes people assume that you're like planting a bomb or something. So they politely asked me to leave and never come back. So I told Virginia Beach City Public School System that I was now homeschooled, and I was going to community college while homeschooled, and so I did 2 semesters in community college and then transferred into Texas A&M Corps of Cadets for the Maritime Academy program. Texas A&M Corps of Cadets, I was the youngest person there by a good margin because I was 15 and the average person going in there was about 25. And I was isolated on an island off the coast of an island, and everyone's pastime was to drink. Not like fun party frat drinking. This wasn't that kind of school. It was like sad, I hate my life, I just don't want to be here kind of drinking. So that's where I learned my drinking from, where you're not supposed to necessarily have a good reason to. Your reason is that you woke up this morning. Which fit in line perfectly with my mentality throughout my life is like, I guess I'm here, how do I forget the fact that I'm here? And before I discovered substances, I knew that there had to be something to take me out of the misery of existing. So after a couple of semesters, I discovered the bottle. Weird thing, because I always told myself I was never going to drink because my parents are alcoholics. It was ingrained in my head from a young age. I was going to AA meetings. I was sitting on the corner playing with toys growing up. But it took about two semesters for me to wake up one morning, go in my refrigerator where my roommate, I almost called him a celly, my roommate had a Coors Light, and I cracked the thing open. And I stumbled around campus three beers deep, having never experienced it before, saying, oh, this is great. Why didn't I do this a long time ago? And I managed to tolerate the rest of college, hopped up on Adderall, and wound down on alcohol. And that was how I managed to deal with a lot of the interpersonal issues at the time, because my weirdness in elementary school and middle school was one thing, but when you go to college when you're 15 and there are people there that are struggling that are 22, 23, 24, they hate you. They hate you for being there, and they hate you for not seeming like you struggle. And I struggle the same as anyone else. I just don't show emotions very well because I've been told I've got a touch of autism. There was an incident of where I had a group project senior year, and there's people who are 22, 23, 24 who are having to work with somebody who's 17, a snot-nosed little kid. And they never contacted me for group projects. I kept on asking them, what part of the project do I do, when do we meet, or whatever, and they just never told me. And then they finished the thing, and then they told the teacher, oh, George didn't do anything. Failed that class, had to take that again. That was a resentment right there. I felt that was pretty unnecessary, but they felt that was necessary because they didn't like me. And that's not my burden to bear anymore. That's their burden to bear, because I don't have to think about that. And they repeat that every time they come into contact with somebody that has something that they don't have and that they want, which I didn't think was me. I didn't think I was any different from them, except in the sense that I didn't have a lot of the skills that they had, a lot of the social skills. But they seemed to think that there was something different about me, that it was worth holding me back a semester. So that was a resentment that I picked up, and feeling that pressure of the school being against me, the world being against me, the way that I'd felt to some extent. My response was drinking. At that point, not particularly egregiously. Maybe not every day, but enough that had become my go-to. That's how I dealt with life. I graduated at 18. I got commissioned as a merchant marine officer. To my knowledge, I was the youngest person ever to be commissioned with this. I got a billet and sailed on a ship when I was 19, and my drinking didn't quite pick up at that point, but I sought out other thrill-seeking behavior. I had, having lacked the camaraderie that you would expect from military college, I found that in other groups of people who had a bad sense of humor. People that were probably involved in parts of politics that they shouldn't have been. And they drank the way that I did, almost. I could still drink most of them under the table, even at, you know, tender 18, 19. But no matter what I said, they wouldn't bat an eye. No matter what joke I told, they thought it was funny. No matter how much I drank, they might not be able to drink the way that I did, but they wouldn't look down on me for it. And there I found camaraderie for the first time. Naturally, I worked my way out of that because I met a woman within those groups who lied about who she was the same way I was lying about who I was. We were both young. I had never seen someone so pretty and eager to like me, and I fell head over heels. It didn't work out, obviously, because we'd met while I was on a ship through a friend, and when I came home, I think she found out that I wasn't who I pretended to be, because people that pretend are never who they pretend to be, and she wasn't who she'd pretended to be. We both had what the other one wanted, and were willing to lie to get that, and that didn't last very long. And I worked my way out of those communities because, mostly because I resented her, and because the other people in those communities picked her over me, which seems really silly, but that was a resentment that I drank on for a long time. That was a resentment that kept me up at night for days. That's a resentment that kept me from eating for days. And as I went on throughout this process, I just drank more. And drinking wasn't at that point even, I want to say it was my whole world. It was definitely the thing that I lived for, because it was the only thing that gave me happiness. Because I'd never felt happiness my whole life up until taking a drink. That's what I thought was happiness anyway. But at that point, drinking started becoming a bit more of a priority, but still wasn't quite to what we'd think of as being alcoholic yet. Although people were talking to me about it. So anyways, I started a podcast because I had kind of worked my way out of these groups of people and into other groups. Different groups, different areas, whatever it was that I thought that there could be camaraderie. What's it, conviviality and a gay time? Or well, I don't know what the big... I thought that I was having a good time when I was drinking and it was fun to drink with certain kinds of people and tell certain kinds of jokes. So I started a podcast because I ran into somebody who had a comedy podcast and was relatively famous within certain circles. And I started a comedy podcast with them. Which had not that many fans, but a few of those fans were FBI agents, as it turns out. But I'll get to that later. I picked shipping. I didn't enjoy working on ships. Well, I guess I enjoyed parts of the job. I picked the career because I liked the money. I liked this idea, this image of who I could be, of not who I was, not who I believed I was, not anything internal, but because I wanted other people to see me a certain kind of way. Money let people see me that way. A title let me see people see me that way. But it didn't change who I was. And I had this feeling, this immediate feeling, fleeting feeling, when I graduated and I got commissioned, that this entire goal that I worked up to, it didn't even make me happy the entire day. Immediately, this is over. Like, what's the next thing? What do we move on to the next thing? How do I get my next fix? How do I impress people or convince people who I am? Wear some kind of mask. What's that next mask that I'm going to wear? And part of that was, and within certain groups, having a comedy podcast, I guess I got a certain kind of status for that. That the money and the prestige of my career never gave me. And actually, the funny thing was that career was kind of did the opposite. Because I was seeking those things that couldn't give me happiness, I pulled myself away from the things that could. I would go off on a ship for 4 months at a time, working 84 hours a week, working myself to the bone. I got an ulcer. I'd get off of a ship maybe once a month, and the first thing I'd do is go. I didn't even go to a bar. I'd go to a 7-Eleven. I'd go to a OXXO if I was in South America. I'd go to. I always forget the ones in Korea, but they've got a booze really cheap, like a bottle of soju, which is, you know, 20% alcohol for a dollar. I wouldn't even see Korea. I'd just see the bottom of a bottle of soju, and I knew that that was a way that I could get to the position that I wanted to be in pretty quickly, was just get a drunk as cheaply and as fast as possible. And so I'd made a fool of myself. I'd show up to the ship drunk. And I didn't consider this alcoholic at the time. I passed out on the bridge of a ship, having the con, being in command of the ship, propping my feet against the bathroom door, the head, if you're all in the Navy, the head door on the bridge of the ship, hoping that if the captain came up and knocked, it would wake me up and I'd just pretend I was going to the bathroom. That was my plan. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that, even over a year after getting sober. I went over to a friend's house, and she was married at the time, in a marriage that I didn't really approve of, to this squirrely little guy, and we all got drunk, and he went to bed, and I ended up, I slept with her. And I woke up the next day and I felt horrible, but I blamed him more than myself because he didn't treat her right. You know, he invited me in his house and got his wife drunk with me. Like, what was he expecting? Of course I blamed him. That had to be on the ninth step list, but of course that ninth step didn't go the way that I intended to. I got my nose broken at a frat party for, a friend of mine. This is all in the period of shipping, by the way. I'm trying to make it chronological. When I was shipping, a friend of mine had smoked the devil's lettuce, a marijuana cigarette, and this part isn't a joke. He actually had psychosis from it, and he jumped off of a ledge and he broke his back because some people just have negative effects sometimes. And I went up to visit him at the college he was going to. And I found out when I got up there what happened. And so I went to his frat party and I got drunk. And I said something that I don't really feel like repeating in front of this many people. And I don't even remember saying it. Somebody mentioned it to me like a month later as I heard a rumor you might have said this. Well, anyways, somebody broke my nose that I wasn't even talking to and then ran away. And I thought, hey, what a asshole. I didn't think, like, why did I say that? You know, I blamed him or... I strangled a dude in Saipan. I don't know that I have time for that story. But I blame that. One day I get off of a ship and I go home to my parents' house in Virginia. And I'm spending the night there, spending the week there. I lived there. I'm going to cut the shit. I lived at the house still, even though I had a career. I still live in that house. Why am I trying to protect my ego? And I hear a knock at the door at about 6 a.m. It's December, I want to say 29th, 2020. And banging really loud. I had no idea what it was. My dad didn't either. He walks downstairs, he opens the door, and I'm right behind him with a handgun because I think that it's a drunk guy, it's a lunatic, who knows what's going on. He opens the door and he sees blue and red flashing lights. He gets grabbed and pulled outside. I put the gun down. I get grabbed and pulled outside. I can't even remember the next few seconds because it was so fast. Everyone in the house, in their underwear, in 30-degree weather, lined up against a brick wall. I had no idea who these people were. I thought that... I had no idea. Maybe I was getting swatted. Until I saw CTU on one of their vests, which... I'm not in the military, so I don't know that much about acronyms, but I could wager meant counterterrorism unit. After they were done going through the house and freezing our asses off for 45 minutes, they pulled me aside and they asked me a couple of questions about people I'd come into contact with, about an event that would come up a week later that I had nothing to do with. They told me to stop having a podcast. I said, okay. No more politics, no more podcasts, no more jokes, forget about it. Lesson learned. And later, a month later, I went to the FBI building with a lawyer and they basically reiterated. So at the time when they went into my house, they found 3 hits of LSD, mushrooms that I thought were magic, but turns out were just portobello mushrooms. That's $300 down the drain. I bought an ounce of mushrooms that were fake. Well, they were real mushrooms. They just... They found... I had a bunch of guns, but, you know, I was allowed to have them. And things called solvent traps. You could buy them on the internet at the time. Some people turned them into silencers. I filed for an ATF form to be able to manufacture a silencer. I was waiting for that to come back, and I hadn't made one at the time, or at least not that they knew. They found these solvent traps, and a month later they mentioned to me, we know they're not silencers. We get that. Stay out of politics, because we can make it look like, we can make it look not only like they're silencers, but that, like, we can make a very interesting story out of this, and you would have a bad time. So I said, okay, I'm out of politics. No more podcasts, no more jokes, no more late nights with the boys getting drunk and talking about stuff we shouldn't be talking about. So the FBI kind of ignored me after this for about 8 months until I was contacted and they said, hey, come to the FBI building. Two guys want to talk to you. Dude that went by Matt and Tom from up in D.C., the people that raided me said, these are our boss's boss's boss. They were from JTTF, Joint Terrorism Task Force, which doesn't really have anything to do with terrorism most of the time. But I didn't really know that at the time. They had a job offer for me. They interviewed me for 2 days, and they were kind of leaning in that direction, and my response was pretty much, I don't want anything to do with politics or any of this kind of stuff anymore. I've been out of it. I'm happy being out of it. I don't want to dip my toes back in the water, not as a participant and definitely not as an informant. And they revealed during that they'd performed some unconstitutional surveillance on me, and that really bothered me, so I ended up yelling at them a little bit, which they didn't appreciate. So I was done with the FBI raid, but I thought I was done with the FBI, but the raid kind of messed me up, and I was drinking pretty heavily at the time. I got out of my parents' house, and while I wasn't working, when I wasn't on a ship, I would wake up in the morning, I'd crack open a White Claw, and it worked its way up from there. And that was another indicator that I was an alcoholic, was when Jameson stopped burning, when liquor stopped burning, and it started just tasting like tea. And I'd have 2 days here or 2 days there where I'd be in a hotel waiting for a class or whatever. And my way of spending those 2 days was to go out and get a handle of Jameson and drink that. That was what I lived for. That when I would go to places, when I visit places, it's because I could drink there. Any place, any time I had to be sober, I was, what's the big book term, killjoy? spoil sport. Wet blanket. I was a real wet blanket because I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be there, I just didn't want to be sober. I thought that my drinking had kind of picked up and I'd spiraled down a little bit. I was an angry person. I gained quite a bit of weight. Even though I never thought I would see the FBI again, it messed me up, and I was definitely even more restless, irritable, and discontent. I got on a ship. I got off the ship. Fired, maybe. Quit, probably. It was mutual. I'll say that. Almost everyone on the in my defense, almost everyone on that ship either got fired or quit after that trip because my watch partner, my helmswoman, she was sexually assaulted on the ship. The captain covered it up. When she reported it to the office investigated and found out the captain covered up a rape on the ship 2 years ago. I was sleeping with my helmswoman. My hands were not clean in that. It was a whole big mess. It had not having nothing to do with the FBI. I was just generally a restless, irritable, and discontent person on that ship. I wasn't effective at my job because of that. I found myself in situations that baffled me, that I had no real direction for. I reacted against people. So I got off the ship and I ended up I was already in Europe. So they gave me a ticket home and they said, go straight home. And I say, screw you. So I went to Croatia instead. And I went from Croatia to Budapest to Prague to Helsinki, Finland, Estonia, and Latvia. And Latvia was where I got a nasty phone call, somebody informing me that the FBI was looking for me, which I blew off because 50-50 chance, the guy doesn't know who he's talking about, and if he does, I've already dealt with them, I'll go back there, I'll talk with them, I'll smooth it over. But that kind of killed the mood a little bit. Latvia down to Estonia, sorry, no, Latvia down to Lithuania, then I went to Poland, then I went to Ukraine. That was during the war, I kind of just wanted to check it out. That wasn't really a sober thing to do, because I wasn't sober when I did it. I wish, like, for most of this trip, like, I wish I could tell you I did cool things. Like, I went to see cathedrals and stuff. I went to see castles. That's my thing, is, like, checking out old architecture. But mostly I was just really drunk. And coming back across the border from Ukraine into Warsaw, it's a four-hour drive, but it took 12 hours because you're going through a refugee border. I was on a refugee bus. It's funny. I should watch my time. It's funny, when I was going into the country, the Polish border guard said, "Excuse me, sir, you know there's a war going on in here." And I said, "Yeah, I know, give me the damn visa." And on the way out, the Ukrainian border guard said, "Sir, you know there's a war going on in here?" And I said, "Yeah, I know." That's a lot of the reason I liked Ukraine, and I liked that sort of being a part of that. But I was drinking on that bus, and that was my last drink. That was July 6th or 7th, I'd have to look it up, of 2022. Because when I got out of Ukraine and I went to Warsaw, flew out of Warsaw to Oslo, the moment I landed in the U.S., I got grabbed by Department of Homeland Security, which wasn't out of the ordinary because I was, and still am, on a terrorist watch list. Not having to do with being raided by the FBI, actually before that, for a different thing, because I took a vacation to Cuba in 2020, and I didn't realize how it looked when a white dude wearing cargo pants, combat boots, and a close-crop haircut flies back into the U.S. with a visa. At the time, in order to get into Cuba, you had to give a reason other than tourism. And the one that seemed open-ended was support for the Cuban people, which I meant I'm supporting with my dollars. But what they meant was, like, a little more communistic. So I had a support for the Cuban people visa. I had a framed picture of Fidel Castro, about three boxes of cigars. It just didn't look good. After that point, every time I get flagged, I get pulled aside in the airport. Coming back, going through domestic takes me an extra hour. Going through international takes me an extra five. I get interviewed every time I enter the country, which is when they did that illegal surveillance going through my laptop. Well, I considered illegal, but they didn't, I guess. I don't know. So coming into the country, DHS grabs me. Nothing new there. I was expecting that. What was scary was when two FBI agents walked in. Because they're usually never in the mix. They put handcuffs on me, and they said I was under arrest. And I said, you know, what for? I didn't know what they were arresting me for. I couldn't think of why they would come down to Florida for me. But it was Friday. They said I could bond out Monday morning. Yeah, it didn't really happen. When I finally got the bond hearing on Friday, it was denied. Not a high bond amount. I was denied bond because they said I was a flight risk and a danger to society. I took diesel therapy, which is just going from bus to bus to bus all the way up through the Federal Bureau of Prisons to get to the place that you go to court. Imagine like flying economy class, but on a bus, and worse because you're spending every night in a prison instead of a hotel. So I ended up going through 11 prisons actually. Total 11 facilities during that. But that was around the period of time where I had no way of dealing with that because my way was alcohol and nicotine and, you know, whatever other party favors. But I started getting into meditation. And with that meditation came reflection because very often I was stuck in a cell by myself and my thoughts. This was the first steps in my sobriety back when sobriety wasn't a choice, was focus, intent. And within about 10 days into my incarceration, I was going through diesel therapy, the bus system. I was stuck in a jail in Atlanta USP, one of the worst prisons in the US. And I called my sister. I remember saying on the phone, "I hope something special is going on here. I hope they don't let me out too soon before this is done." And my sister said, "I don't think you should be worried about that." So I ended up going to Western Tidewater Regional Jail, where they didn't really feed me a lot. I lost 40 pounds in there. Didn't get a lot of sleep. They don't turn the lights off at night. Could not get, there wasn't a library. You couldn't get books in there. You could get mail, but you'd never receive it because they just scanned it and put it on these tablets, which were occupied by the gangs. The gangs would take the tablets, so you didn't really necessarily have access to it. So you couldn't get mail, couldn't get visits. It was not a fun time. I was there for about 7 months, and still thinking maybe I'll bond out, maybe I'll get found not guilty or whatever, holding on to this idea that I'm innocent, why am I here? Until my lawyer said, if you plead guilty, you'll probably get time served. If you don't plead guilty, we'll arrest your brother. They'll make up something. There was loose things, but the point is, if they could grasp at straws for me, they could grasp at straws for anyone. And when they threatened, I believed it. So I pled guilty. That was a relief, because at that point, at least, when we went to prison, I was looking forward to prison because I knew I could sleep. It was dark at night. It was quiet at night. They would feed you. You could get books. You know, you could get visits. And to me, being in jail, prison sounded like heaven. And it was a massive upgrade, I'll say. When I was in prison, I started teaching yoga. I started learning yoga. I started teaching yoga. I practiced more meditation every day than I taught meditation. To one guy, if I don't catch myself, I'll sanitize it to the point to where people aren't getting the right idea. One guy asked me to teach him meditation. I stopped teaching him meditation because I was sitting there, you know, instructing him through, walking him through, and I was like, wow, you're really relaxed. Like, you're more relaxed than I am. Good job. Oh, no, he's high. Never mind. Dude was smoking the stuff called K2, but throughout this process, I'd gone to a couple meetings in prison, which is weird because almost everyone in there has something to do with drugs or alcohol. But there were three people in the AA meeting, including me. And the two people there, other people, were sex offenders. They had nothing to do with it. Nobody there had a drug or alcohol charge. I had a firearms charge. So I had been sober 2 years at the point where I was released. I didn't have a good roadmap on how to live before going to prison. Once you're institutionalized for 2 years, it's very difficult to re-enter society, especially as a pariah. And I had no map to living. I didn't have a map to living before, but I had a lot of cash and I had a career, and you can tie most things together with that. I had drinking, which meant that I didn't have to think about all those bad things. But afterwards, I really didn't know how to live. Getting out of prison, I freaked out in a Burger King when my parents picked me up and drove me out. It was just too different. I didn't know how to handle it. But my solution was, I'm gonna join AA and I'm gonna do the steps. Because the 2 years I was in prison were the best 2 years of my life. Because for the first time, I didn't constantly feel pain. I didn't constantly hate my life. I don't know why, because I hadn't worked the steps at that point. But I'd almost done an earlier version of it, the way I would say. No substitution for the steps, but something to hold me over for the time being. And I needed that because I now didn't have a career. Anyone that looked at my name would think that I was a terrorist. They released articles that if anyone looked me up, I would instantly, any girl I went on a date with, any job I interviewed for, if they happened to look me up, and who doesn't, they would see articles, which half of it was true, part of it wasn't, a lot of it was taken out of context. It's all about a 19-year-old drunk saying stuff on the internet. And that was rough, is having to have that hang over my head. Because there was another newspaper article from when I was 19 or 18 where I was the youngest merchant marine officer in history. And then there's the second one, which is now the thing that they find, going from that article to this article, where now if somebody looks me up, they think that I'm a nut job, terrorist, you know, whatever. And that was a big hit to my ego, but that was necessary. All of this was necessary for me to get sober. And there was no part of this that I could have done without and still found happiness and found sobriety. So I needed to get out of this cycle that alcohol put me in, and I needed a way out of it without going back to prison. I needed a method for living, and so before I was even off of house arrest, my brother, who's also in the program, brought a meeting into my house with this weird dude who looked like a walrus, this crazy big mustache. And I asked him, hey, do you know somebody that can sponsor people? And he said, yeah, you need a sponsor? And he asked me, are you an alcoholic? Yeah, I'd say I'm an alcoholic. Are you willing to do anything for victory over alcohol? This guy had a really creepy mustache, so I kind of gave him a weird look for that. But I said yes regardless. I didn't really mean it at the time, but I said yes. And he said, what time can you call me every day? And I said, I don't know, seven or whatever it was. That person took me through the steps, and I went through the steps in probably 5-6 months, that taught me not only everything I needed to get out of prison and to get out of that institutionalization, but to get out of everything that had happened before that. It was the way that I continued my progress that I found in prison. It was the way that I stayed sober. It was the way that I found peace and continued on with that peace. It's the way that I cleaned up the messes that I made before prison, made amends to the people that I'd hurt by being in prison, because I was willing to discount that grief if I'd been allowed to, and to re-enter the world. It's the only, in my opinion, hey, it's really the only re-entry program that works the way that it's supposed to. The good thing is the humiliation of returning back to society is actually kind of a benefit to working the steps, you know, because if you're making minimum wage, knocked down, way down to your level, a pariah to all people, a felon, you're not too good for the steps. That's what I needed. So it was kind of shaky, but that was, that kind of pulled me back together. And it was great because I didn't have any answers to anything before in life. But there wasn't a question that I could think of that sooner or later, working the steps and a present higher power, I could not have an answer to. And that was enormously concerning to me. Sometimes, most of the time, that answer was, does it even matter? But I always had an answer. I never went for too long with nothing, with an emptiness, which was important for me because I needed something to fill that hole. I also, because the church, the religion that I went to before prison, was also not well liked by the FBI, and so my probation officer said, no, you can't go to them anymore, which I probably shouldn't have asked, because then he had the ability to say no, but I've had to make my way without being able to go to my religion, by having a personal relationship. The fortunate thing is AA's got the ideal way of forming a personal relationship with your higher power, whatever that is. And because of that, I was able to continue on with my religious practices without being able to practice with other people. Without being able to practice with other people who believe the same thing as me, because within these rooms, I can talk about my higher power, and it doesn't matter because you guys don't know what he looks like, but you don't have to. So that was a substitute and vastly more. I always forget the exact, you know, big book verbiage. Let's see. This is also the only community that would ever accept me. On the way over here, I drove with somebody and I showed them, you know, articles about me. And in any other community, you know, yeah, you talk about stuff, you share different rough stuff that we've done in life. And this is the only community where that would be accepted, where I could tell a person exactly who I am, and they wouldn't hold that against me because we've all been there. We were all alcoholics. We all did a lot of bad stuff. But we all moved past it, and we all took accountability. And this is really the only community that I could find, not only the camaraderie now, the only community I could find camaraderie in, But in hindsight, probably the only community I ever would have found lasting, sustainable, happy camaraderie in before. It's just that I went about it in such a wrong way. Because I never matured past the age of 16 when I first, 17, 16, when I first took my drink. Something about when I was drinking, it was like I was still a child. And when I stopped drinking and I started doing the steps, immediately I started maturing to a point to where it was intimidating. And I've known a lot of other people that had the same thing. Some people that quit drinking at the age of 40 and mature 20 years over the span of 2 years of doing the steps. I'll talk a little bit about like the way that I did the steps, because I find that everyone does them differently, and they definitely presented themselves to me as differently than what I expected them to be when I first read the Big Book. Which, when I first read the Big Book, I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous, the book, was the Big Book, because it wasn't very big. It was just in the church library. So I read it, and I said, hey, all this seems kind of easy, but it seems kind of pointless. I feel like I've done it anyway. And then I got a sponsor, and the sponsor walks you through it. I didn't claim I'd done the 12 steps before. I just felt like they weren't necessary, and then the sponsor let me know they were necessary. Coming to believe that I'm powerless over alcohol, and that my life had become unmanageable, but I didn't attribute it to alcohol. And that particular part wasn't necessarily because of alcohol. It was because of the things that led me to alcohol that also led me to other thrill-seeking behaviors. When I went through the first step, I want to say, when I first grasped the idea that I was an alcoholic, I'd been in prison for about a year and a half, and I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was a year and a half sober. My brain had dried out. I'd had a little more accountability because of meditation, and then I started to realize, no, that drinking this way isn't normal. That was when I kind of had the idea of the first step, but of course you go through it and then you realize that you had that idea. Step two, I'd gone to organized religion, but I didn't have a personal relationship with my higher power, and I didn't know how to do that. And I find that a lot of people that go to organized religion have this degree of separation between them and their higher power, because there isn't necessarily, they aren't handed a roadmap from, you know, growing up to be able to establish the relationship. But AA does that, whatever that is. Because the weird thing about the second step is, even if you don't believe in God, if you just pretend he's there, he shows up. You go through the motions, you pray to a God you don't even believe in, and the God will appear, which is a remarkable thing. But it's also why the steps take so long, because you're waiting for that feedback. You're thinking, hey, am I an alcoholic? And then you wait a week or two, and then, oh, that thing. Yeah, I haven't talked about that. And then, you know, you don't believe in God, but you get on your knees and you pray, because that's what my sponsor told me to do, is pray. Doesn't even matter if you believe in a God necessarily. You pray every day, and when you do, I firmly believe that a God will show up, and that God will help you stay sober if you ask him to. And tell you the truth, that God will do anything to help you. You just may not know that that's helping you at your time. The way that I didn't realize that it was necessary, I am glad that I went to prison, because that is what I needed to get sober and to stay happy. And step three, that was the hardest for me, because I'm a control freak. I use thrills for control. Everything in my life is about making things go my way, and that's not particularly different, I think, than most people in this room. And I've had to repeat that for months and months when I was first doing the steps, of something wasn't going my way, and I had to intentionally let it go, and intentionally let it go, and intentionally let it go. And after a while, that stuck well enough that it didn't have to be so intentional anymore. It started becoming sympathetic. Step four and five, I didn't realize how bad of a job I did that the first time until I took a sponsee through it, and I realized he just did a way better job than me, because I hadn't really gotten down to the exact nature of my wrongs. So going through it with a sponsee, then I had to go back through it and get a better idea of really distilling down into say one word. If I was going to say that one word, I'd probably say control. And then a couple of the little things there that to focus on, of things that I was willing to hold on to for 6 and 7 that I wasn't ready to let go because I'd love my character defects. But if I can identify it and I can pin it up on the board, when I'm ready, I can finally recognize that that thing never made me happy. It's not that it no longer makes me happy. It's that it didn't, and I didn't quite recognize that until that, I'm not going to say rock bottom, but you could say a specific rock bottom for a specific incident of, I did this thing that I'd always done, and now I realized that that hadn't gotten me the results that I'd wanted it to. So I now, months after even doing the 12th step, I can let that thing go finally. One by one, I can get rid of those character defects. I might not identify them all in one go, and I might not let go of all of them in one go, but now I finally can. 8 and 9, making amends. I did a victory lap for my 9th step, which you're never supposed to talk to ex-girlfriends for a reason. I didn't do any of these steps perfectly, but you don't need to. You just gotta show up. You just gotta try. So I made amends to my family. I made amends to a lot of things that didn't make any sense to me because the things that I told them about that I thought hurt them weren't the things that hurt them. And that was important because when I made amends to them, I wasn't just making amends for the things that I thought of. They told me the things that I didn't. And because of that, I learned more about their perspective so that I could be truly not selfish, which was the crux of my being. 10, 11, 12, I do a little inventory every night. I ask myself, I don't read whatever page that is, the one in the morning and the one at night anymore. I ask, was I selfish? Was I dishonest? Was I resentful? Was I fearful? At first, it was just me asking myself if I fucked anyone over that day. But then I expanded it and made it a little less vulgar. Then my 11th step that I do every night is I list 10 things I'm grateful for, and if I can't list those things, I have to ask myself if I still turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, because that'll slip if I don't keep an eye on it, so I have to do that every night. And then 12th step, I ask myself who I helped that day, because if I go too long, if I didn't help somebody get sober that day, at the very least I should recognize that, and then maybe the next day I'll try better. Thank you for letting me share.
That was fucking awesome, dude. You fucking